All right, welcome in everybody for another deep dive here. Today, we're going to be looking into this Michigan case, Taylor versus Kurapati. And, you know, this isn't just some dry legal procedure stuff. It gets into some pretty deep questions, like how the law is trying to handle, you know, all the advancements in medical tech and reproductive rights, and like, what does it even mean to value life, you know, as a society? So yeah. If you're at all interested in like the nitty gritty of how medical malpractice timelines work, or this whole concept of wrongful birth, this deep dive is going to be right up your alley.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really going to kind of peel back the layers on Taylor versus Kurapati here. I mean, it's a case that not only sheds light on some of the tricky legal rules, but it also it really forces us to grapple with some really personal and ethically charged questions.
Yeah.
At the heart of it all, we have a couple of pretty straightforward questions. You know, did the Taylors actually file their malpractice claim in time? And does Michigan law even recognize this idea of wrongful birth?
Right.
And the answers that came out of this case, they've had a really big impact on the legal landscape, you know, specifically in Michigan.
Yeah, and the story starts, you know, with that kind of hope that every parent-to-be has, right? You know, the sources lay out how Brandi Taylor, she has her first ultrasound in December of 93 with Dr. Kurapati, and the initial report shows everything looks normal. I mean, can you imagine, like, that sigh of relief, you know?
Absolutely.
Everything's looking good.
You know, I think that's something that we can all relate to, right? Mm-hmm. That initial sigh of relief that, you know.
Yeah.
But then just a few months later, in March of 94, there's a follow-up ultrasound. And this time it reveals some potential issues. Mm-hmm. Specifically, it looks like the fetus has these short femur bones.
Mm-hmm.
So the Taylors, they're informed about this, and the doctors, they suggest the possibility of doing some more detailed imaging, you know, to get a clear picture.
Right.
But for reasons that are laid out in the source material, the Taylors decide not to pursue those additional tests.
Right.
So then in April of 94, their daughter, Shelby, is born. And tragically, she's born with these significant disabilities. It's hard to even, you know, hear about this stuff. Missing limbs, fused joints, missing fingers and toes.
Wow.
Later on, she's diagnosed with something called femur fibula ulna syndrome. It's just a heartbreaking situation. You know, no family should ever have to face something like
that.
Yeah,
absolutely not.
So understandably, the Taylors, they're looking for answers. They want to know what happened, and they turn to the legal system, as many people do in these situations. So in March of 1996, they file a lawsuit against Dr. Kurapati in Annapolis Hospital. And their lawsuit has kind of two main parts to it.
Hmm.
The first is a claim of medical malpractice. You know, they're alleging that the doctor failed to detect Shelby's condition during those ultrasounds.
Right.
And the second part of the lawsuit is a claim for wrongful birth, which argues that this failure to detect, you know, deprived them of the opportunity to make informed choices about the pregnancy.
So, okay, so the lawsuit's filed, and they run right into a roadblock with that first claim, the medical malpractice claim. It's dismissed pretty quickly. What happened there? What was the legal issue?
That brings us to this crucial legal concept called the statute of limitations. You know, in Michigan, just like a lot of other states, there's a time limit for how long you have to file a lawsuit after some alleged act of negligence has happened. Mm. And back then, in medical malpractice cases in Michigan, that clock, it started ticking from the moment that negligent act occurred.
Okay, so help me unpack that a little. In the Taylor's case, the alleged negligence was the way that first ultrasound back in December of 93 was interpreted. But their lawsuit didn't get filed until March of 96, which is, what, over 2 years later?
Exactly. And Michigan, they operate under something called the accrual rule in these types of cases. Basically what that means is that the statute of limitations starts when the negligent act happens, not when the patient discovers the harm that resulted from it.
Gotcha.
And that's a really important distinction from the discovery rule that some other states use. Think of it this way. If you had a builder who used like shoddy materials to build your house back in, say, 93, the clock might start ticking for you to sue them right then, even if your roof doesn't start leaking and you don't realize there's a problem until 95, you see.
Yeah, I get it. So the Taylors, they tried to argue for something called equitable tolling, right? Which is this legal principle that could basically pause the clock or extend that deadline, you know, under certain circumstances.
Right.
But the court didn't buy it. They didn't think it applied in this specific case.
Exactly. The court didn't find that there were sufficient grounds to use equitable tolling in this particular instance.
So the medical malpractice part of the lawsuit was done. But the second part, the claim for wrongful birth, that's where things get really interesting and where this case, you know, really makes its mark on Michigan law. Can you explain what exactly wrongful birth means, like legally speaking?
Sure. A wrongful birth claim, it's brought by parents who are saying that they were given, you know, negligent medical advice or treatment that prevented them from making a choice to avoid the birth of a child with disabilities. They're essentially arguing that if the healthcare providers had done their job properly, like if they had correctly diagnosed a fetal abnormality, the parents would have made different decisions about the pregnancy. And those decisions, you know, they could include terminating the pregnancy.
Okay, so in Taylor v. Kuropaty, the Michigan Court of Appeals, they didn't just rule on this specific case. They actually made this pretty sweeping statement basically saying that the whole idea of wrongful birth, it's not a thing anymore in Michigan. It's not going to be recognized. That's a huge decision. What was their reasoning there? What was behind that?
Well, the majority opinion, it was very clear. They decided that wrongful birth is fundamentally unsound and goes against public policy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest concerns they had was that allowing wrongful birth claims could actually end up, you know, encouraging eugenic thinking.
Oh, wow.
They were worried that these claims could, even if it wasn't intentional, lead to people thinking that the lives of people with disabilities are somehow less valuable.
Yeah. You know, there's this powerful quote that really stuck with me from the source material. If all life is presumptively valuable, how can we say that what we really mean is that all lives except for the lives of the disabled are presumptively valuable?
Right.
It really gets you thinking, you know?
Absolutely. And the majority opinion in this case, they believed that saying there's a legal cause of action for wrongful birth, that it would imply that it would have been better if a child with disabilities was never born.
Yeah.
And they also emphasize this idea of the separation of powers. You know, they were basically saying that if we're going to create legal liability in such a sensitive and ethically complex area, that's something that should be decided by the legislature, not the courts.
So a pretty clear rejection of the idea of wrongful birth from the majority of the court. But like we see a lot in the law, it wasn't a totally unanimous decision, right? There was a concurring opinion that offered a different take on this whole wrongful birth question.
That's right. You know, the concurring opinion, while it agreed that the Taylor's lawsuit should be dismissed because of that statute of limitations issue, it strongly disagreed with the majority's decision to just get rid of the wrongful birth tort entirely.
Mm-hmm.
The concurring judge pointed out that the question of whether or not Michigan law should even recognize wrongful birth, it wasn't actually the main issue in this specific appeal.
Oh.
You know, the lawyers hadn't specifically argued about it, and the trial court hadn't made a ruling on it.
So the concurring judge was basically saying the majority went too far. Like they made this big statement about wrongful birth when it wasn't even really the main point of the case.
Exactly. The concurring opinion called the majority's statements about wrongful birth non-binding dicta. And, you know, for those listeners who might not be legal experts, dicta basically means statements that a court makes that aren't actually essential to the decision in the case. So because the lawsuit was dismissed based on that statute of limitations thing, the majority's strong opinions about wrongful birth, they weren't strictly necessary to decide the appeal. The concurring judge felt that the majority was overstepping their boundaries, you know, making this broad policy statement on an issue that wasn't the direct focus of the appeal.
That's a really important distinction. So we have this strong stance from the majority saying no more wrongful birth in Michigan. And then this other judge saying, hey, hold on, you didn't even need to say all that. What happened after all of that? Did Taylor v. Kuropaty completely settle this whole wrongful birth question in Michigan?
Well, in the immediate aftermath, Taylor v. Kuropaty definitely sent a pretty strong message about how Michigan courts were going to view these wrongful birth claims.
Right.
But the story doesn't end there. A few years later, in 2000, the Michigan legislature actually passed a law, Public Act 423. And this act officially banned both wrongful birth claims, which are brought by the parents, and what are called wrongful life claims.
Okay, hold on a sec. Let's make sure everyone's clear on what wrongful life means. How is that different from wrongful birth?
So a wrongful life claim, it's typically brought by the child themselves. They're alleging that a healthcare provider was negligent and that negligence resulted in them being born with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
They're essentially saying that their life with these disabilities is a harm and that it would have been better if they were never born. And Public Act 423, it specifically said that Michigan courts will not recognize wrongful life claims. they had a lot of the same concerns about wrongful life claims as they did with wrongful birth claims. Mainly, they were worried about sending the message that the lives of people with disabilities are less valuable.
So Taylor v. Koropaty, it seems like it really kind of kicked off this whole process that led to this new law, Public Act 423, and that really solidified Michigan's stance on these types of claims. It's pretty heavy stuff, right? It brings up all these big ethical questions about a parent's right to make informed choices about having kids and the idea that all human life has value no matter what.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
These kinds of cases, they force us to really think about these really difficult questions. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you have people arguing that doctors and nurses, they have a responsibility to give accurate information. And if they screw up and don't do that, and parents lose the chance to make informed choices about their family, then those parents should have some kind of legal recourse. But then on the other hand, you have this very valid concern that allowing wrongful birth claims could send the message, even if it's not intentional, that a life with disabilities is somehow less worthy. It's a tough balancing act, trying to weigh the desire to prevent harm against the need to make it clear that every single person has value.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Taylor v. Koropaty, what are the key takeaways here? What do you think our listeners should really remember?
Okay, so first and foremost, it's super important to understand that in Michigan, the statute of limitations for medical malpractice claims is very strict.
Right.
That clock starts ticking when the alleged negligence happens, not when the person realizes they've been harmed. And that's ultimately what led to the dismissal of the Taylor's medical malpractice claim.
Right.
And the second big takeaway, which has even bigger implications for the law and ethics, is that Michigan courts don't recognize wrongful birth as a valid legal claim. And that stance is really based on this deep concern about potentially devaluing the lives of people with disabilities and this idea that such fundamental legal and ethical changes should be made by the legislature, not the courts.
It definitely makes you think, how should the legal system even begin to deal with these really complex ethical issues that come up when you're talking about medical negligence and reproductive rights and the value of life? I mean, there's no easy answer here.
You're absolutely right. And it's an ongoing conversation in our society.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you listening who are interested in learning more, I'd recommend looking into how other states have handled wrongful birth and wrongful life claims. You'll find a whole range of approaches which reflects the different legal and ethical perspectives across the country.
Right.
And taking some time to consider the ongoing ethical debates around these issues, that can also help you understand the complexities involved.
Yeah, for sure. It's a topic that keeps generating discussion and a lot of different viewpoints. Well, that brings us to the end of our deep dive into Taylor v. Koropaty. Hopefully this has given everyone a clearer understanding of this important case and the complicated legal and ethical questions that it raises. We'll be back soon with another deep dive into the cases and concepts that shape the way we see the world. Until then, keep exploring.